It is 8:30, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And 8:30 also means that we are joined by Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State.
Yes.
I almost did that Seattle Weekly thing. You know, we did that for like 4.5 years.
That's true.
Well, I guess it was The Stranger for a while.
Yeah, that's true.
I guess I eventually got retrained.
Well, you know, I'm still doing the Weekly, but some of the people in the room aren't. So, but that's, which is good. It's very good, actually. Are they like trying to hang meat in here on Friday nights or something? It's chilly in here.
I know.
We just barely got that moved out before you came in.
I was wondering what the big hooks over in the corner were for.
I was wondering what the little puddles of blood were.
Yeah. What do they do in here on Friday nights?
Anyway, yeah,
I wasn't going to ask.
We cut a lot more than discs here.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so they were talking about Fast Track on...
Yeah, and because the program Counterspin, it's a fine program, but it is recorded, I believe, on Thursday mornings, so they wouldn't have known at that point that it was not only passed by the Senate, but signed into law as soon as possible by our dimmest president. It's remarkable, of course, that the Senate and the House, after spending so many years battling this, and it was a big public thing, and every year there would be this massive debate on it, and so this year there was no public debate on it. They snuck it through at 3 a.m. on Saturday morning last week, and for some reason we now have trust in our president and the executive branch and in blank check for corporations that we didn't have for some reason in past years. So the same week that President Bush and any number of members of Congress are out there grandstanding before the public talking about how we're cutting down on corporate crime and corporate fraud and corporations are no longer going to run things in Washington. Well, maybe they didn't quite say that, but it was no longer going to be corporate business as usual. And yet at the same time, the same corporate lobbyists who had descended en masse to make sure that the corporate fraud bill contained, you know, no real significant changes, and the changes that were in there, while they were minor first steps that were good first steps, probably aren't going to be meaningfully enforced. Those same lobbyists also came in and said, oh, by the way, we desperately want Fast Track, and how's your reelection campaign this fall going? And golly gee, they passed it with flying colors this time at 3 in the morning. Both of our senators in Washington State, Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray, voted for Fast Track.
They are so good.
Yeah, because they have so much personal admiration and trust in President George W. Bush, and for that matter, any future presidents that we might have.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's good news. So people can be calling Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray to express their thanks.
for giving away
the store, literally.
Yeah, literally giving away the store. And, at this point, it's sort of on to the next battle, having lost the last one. But at the same time, there is getting to be more and more momentum for, cracking down on corporate rule of Washington, D.C., and of our elected officials in this state. And Cantwell and Murray are a very good place to start because, that's where they get their money. And they are doing the exact same thing that other Beltway politicians are doing. In fact, Murray more so because of her position within the Democratic Party.
And Murray doesn't have the deep pockets that Maria Cantwell does.
Yeah, Murray doesn't have the deep pockets, and also Murray doesn't, bother to trouble herself by paying attention to anything going on the Senate floor or, introducing legislation or particularly paying attention to the needs of Washington State. And so she's spending all of her time, and Cantwell's doing a fair amount of it too, raising soft money from contributions from big donors that will be illegal in a couple of months, unless they've found a new loophole, which they probably already have.
Mm. All right. Well,
cheery good morning to you.
Yes. I grabbed the paper on the way out the door this morning, and you couldn't help but see the headline: release names of September 11th detainees, U.S. judge orders.
Yes.
Hopefully this will be more of the judicial backlash against the Ashcroft Department of Justice.
Yeah, it was all over the news yesterday, and coincidentally, and a very, very good language from the judge on the ruling.
Yeah, I have the quote right here. The quote is, "The first priority of the judicial branch must be to ensure that our government always operates within the statutory and constitutional constraints which distinguish a democracy from a dictatorship."
Which is pretty explicit, really.
Yeah, it really says it all.
You can't get any more blunt than that. At the same time, we've talked on this program a couple times over the past few weeks about the story that I've been working on, and I wrote in passing about it a few weeks ago in Working Assets. The Tunisian gentleman, Elias Glissia, who was detained in the days after September 11th in a truly Kafkaesque series of mix-ups involving wild stories from a housemate who had a grudge and told a sheriff's deputy that she thought her housemate was a Middle East terrorist, and the FBI is not interested, but they threw him in jail, and the INS has been holding him ever since. And, one of these detainees, whose names have not been made public, we only know about it because his lawyer contacted us directly. And so I've been working on this story actually for the past couple of months, and trying as part of that to get myself and a photographer in to meet this guy. And as we've told the INS, to assess whether he and his story, lawyer's stories, are legit and on the up and up. After getting the runaround for 5 or 6 weeks, we got the word on Friday that the INS is detaining, or I'm sorry, not detaining, they may be doing that soon too, but they are denying my request to meet with this guy for national security reasons. So we're going to court. So stay tuned for further details on that. But
when you say we, who's we?
We'll find out who signs on to it eventually, but the legal counsel at this point, the plaintiffs would include myself, the detainee, the lawyers for the detainee, and the Seattle Weekly at minimum. The ACLU may be involved. We're doing some research to find out whether there are similar cases in other parts of the country that could be joined in with this, because this is something, again, that as precedent needs to be set for, where they're essentially denying the free speech rights for a man who has not been charged with any crime, for a man who has been thrown in jail indefinitely. And really, as with releasing the names of the detainees, the courts are the only recourse at this point, because you're not getting any exercises in political courage from any of our legislative branch leaders. And you're certainly not getting it out of John Ashcroft in the Justice Department, or people like Michael Crepy, who's the head of the INS, who works for John Ashcroft, or the regional director of the INS, who works for him. And, it's a daisy chain all the way down of people who are covering their butts because they're afraid of
John
the tone
Ashcroft.
Of terror that John Ashcroft has set all through the justice system in this country. And that is a major reason why John Ashcroft has to go. We talked about this last week. A dump Ashcroft campaign would mean a dramatic improvement in the lives of an unknown number of people in this country, because we have no idea how many people have been thrown in jail that we don't know about, have been getting sentences that they don't deserve that we don't know about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Or who have been kicked out of the country we don't know about, and
yeah.
We don't know whether or not they were kicked out of the country just arbitrarily or because they had real visa violations or other problems.
And even if they had real visa violations, whether they would have been superseded by asylum requests,
exactly.
Or other things that before September 11th never would have them gotten them deported in the way they have been now. And we don't know how many of those people, because they were labeled terrorists by the United States and then deported to their despotic, Middle Eastern Islamic dictatorships whose secret polices are all trained by the United States, we don't know how many people, those people are in dungeons or dead now in those countries. We had the same discussion around torture, where the United States, we won't necessarily engage in torture ourselves. We'll just ship out these prisoners to allies that do use torture. And the same thing is happening with some of these detainees, too. We can't throw them in jail without trial indefinitely, although we're doing that, too. But we can certainly ship them or, quote-unquote, deport them out to countries that will turn around and do the same thing.
Didn't the U.S. just recently opt out on a vote?
Tried to
torture.
Block a protocol to the UN Torture Convention, and unfortunately they were unsuccessful because the vote was taken on the UN General Assembly floor instead of in the Security Council, which is the U.S. dominates.
Yeah.
So the U.S. lost on that point.
Yeah. The U.S. also had a very interesting situation with the U.N. this week around a report that came out of the, well, a couple of them, but a report that, came out of Afghanistan that observers for the United Nations, aid workers actually, at the wedding party bombing that happened about, what, 4 or 5 weeks ago now, mm-hmm. where the London Times reported on, I believe it was Monday, that that the UN was set to release this report. It's interesting, the London Times, a very conservative paper in Britain, reported that this report was just scathing toward the United States, that it said that there was actually no ground fire that prompted the bombing, that there was no evidence
What had happened is U.S. warplanes were searching for Mullah Muhammad Omar in an area where his home village was. They bombed some villages in southeastern Afghanistan, ended up killing 48 people and wiping out most of the members of a wedding party. And this was in a village where, and among a family that were strong supporters of the current government in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And it was a big stink in Afghanistan. The Afghan government was extremely angry, as were many Afghan civilians.
And these include our hand-picked officials.
Right, and the UN sent observers, aid workers, in almost immediately, afterwards,
yeah,
to look at the situation and to do a preliminary report. And what they found, at the London Times said in their report, was that what they found in this and what they said in the preliminary report is that it looked as if U.S. troops had gone in immediately after the bombing and cleaned the site, had picked up bullets and shrapnel, cleaned up blood, and had attempted to cover it up.
Yeah. Well, there was the lack of fire.
Right. And that according to witnesses on the ground, and their stories were all, none of them conflicted, they were all consistent, was that there was no fire from the ground at these planes. And so immediately there was pressure put on the UN, head of the UN mission, his name is Brahimi, in Afghanistan, to not release the report. And so what he did is, instead of releasing the report to the public so that we can actually see what the UN monitors found, he gave the report to the U.S. government and the Afghan government and said that he's not making it public.
Yeah, and of course the Afghan government, which is essentially appointed by the U.S. government, and the U.S. government are not inclined to make it public either.
Right, and what you have to understand too is Brahimi has been in Afghanistan for a long time trying to broker peace since the Civil War in the early 90s. He's going to be particularly susceptible to pressure from the U.S. To go along with the program so that the U.S. will continue giving aid and support to the Afghan government.
The other thing that was interesting about that particular incident is the difference in media coverage in it, once again, between the London Times and then other British papers that picked it up, and things like the New York Times, and there were actually some wire service stories that appeared in our local papers as well. And the stories that appeared in our local papers talked all about the process of the release of the report. It talked about whether the UN observers were qualified or not. You know, basically all of the United States concerns. It talked very little about the actual content of the report, which was, you know, the first 5 or 6 paragraphs in almost all of the stories in the foreign press. It was really downplayed in this country. It was very, very interesting.
Yeah, I want to contrast that with the UN report on the Jenin massacre. We're moving from Afghanistan to Palestine right now. In fact, the press coverage,
world tour.
the UN released a report on Jenin, and you have to think back now to what happened in Jenin. Israeli tanks rolled in. They leveled a whole, 400 by 500 foot region of the camp, in the very center of the camp. It's very, very densely populated. People's houses were bulldozed before they were given, and they were given no warning that they were going to be bulldozed. So there's questions about bodies that were buried in the rubble.
In the middle of the night,
There was no rescue efforts made at all after the fact, and UN observers were not allowed into the camp process or after.
Yeah, in fact, rescue efforts were blocked by the Israeli army.
Yes, ambulances. ambulances were blocked from going into the camp, et cetera.
And people, so there was medical workers detained and arrested in the whole trip.
Exactly. Yeah. So there was discussion that there had been a massacre at Jenin, and the UN did a report on it. But you have to remember, UN observers were not allowed into the camp during the activity by the Israeli military. They were not allowed in afterwards either. The Israeli government blocked them from doing any kind of investigation. Now, the press that has reported on this report, and the UN released their report, they said that there was no evidence that there was a massacre at Jenin. Now,
they said they were unable to obtain any evidence.
Right, exactly.
Which
and
is a
the
little
press,
different.
The press coverage, though, was exactly as I stated. The press coverage was all on the contents of the report and none on how the report was prepared. The press coverage said, oh, no evidence of massacre in Jenin, no evidence of massacres, you know, and the UN is blaming both sides for targeting civilians. However, there was no discussion of how any evidence, such evidence as they had, was obtained. In fact, there were no UN observers in Jenin. They were not allowed to look at any of the bodies that were brought out of the ruins. They were not allowed to interview any witnesses. They were not allowed to talk to aid workers. So,
in fact, they left the country. There was this awkward standoff at the end of, I believe it was at the end of April, where UN observers came in to Israel. They tried to get access. There were negotiations for several days. They thought they had a deal. The deal fell through, and they left.
And they left without talking to anybody or looking at the site or even being able to get within a mile of the site. So it's amazing. There's a discussion of complete discussion of the contents of the report, but no discussion at all of how it was drawn up.
Which is precisely the opposite.
The opposite mm-hmm. of what happened in Afghanistan.
Okay. Well, continue.
Your media deconstruction for a Saturday morning.
Yeah, you're leaving a big mess on that side of the table. So, continuing our whirlwind world tour, it seems that the dialogue in the media now is no longer even questioning a U.S. intervention or attack war in Iraq. It's just a question of where we're going to focus.
Well, no,
it's
been like that for the last year, where there has been and you'll notice this in any of the media coverage, but it's not just the media. It's also the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, chaired by Democrat Senator Joseph Biden, also an ardent supporter of Star Wars. National Missile Defense. all of the debate in the media and among Democrats and Republicans alike is things like, well, should we go in by air or should we have a ground invasion first?
Should we have 60,000 troops or 120,000?
Yeah, exactly. Who's going to succeed Saddam Hussein after we kill him? Yada, yada, yada.
Will Iraq split into three pieces with the Kurds in one piece, the Shiites in another, and Sunni Muslims in a third?
Yeah, which, you know, if you have to name these new countries, I think Texas or Houston would be a good name for the Shiite version in the South, since that's a lot of what it's about. But it's been very interesting that if you contrast this with 12 years ago, with George Sr., then you had a much more explicit reason, you can agree with it or disagree with it, for an actual military intervention, which was that Iraq had in fact invaded a neighboring country in Kuwait. And there was a long buildup, 6 months, Operation Desert Shield, because at that point we were ostensibly protecting Saudi Arabia, even though even then there was plenty of evidence that Saudi Arabia was never threatened. But there was enormous public debate around whether attacking not Iraq, but even attacking Iraqi soldiers in Kuwait to dislodge them from Kuwait was appropriate or not. There was a congressional vote at one point. In the House, there were over 200 votes against it. It passed very, very narrowly. The polls, national
and
polls, were split basically 50-50. There were enormous protests.
There were a lot of people on the street who believed that we shouldn't.
The night before, George Bush Sr.'s line in the sand deadline of Martin Luther King's birthday, there were anywhere from 30,000 to 60,000 people up on Capitol Hill. There were, folks occupying the federal building and on I-5 and in the Olympia Capitol building, and that was going on all over the country. For months and months and months, there was this enormous public debate. We're having none of that this time, even though we're talking about actually a much larger and much riskier and much more destructive operation, even though we're talking about it in the context of 12 years later, where we've proven, A, that it's not going to help anything, B, we've already seen over a million Iraqi soldiers dead, civilians dead, rather, I'm sorry, over half of them children, probably more than that, since those figures, you know, many of them are from the mid and late 80s, or 90s. And then you get headlines in the paper, you know, Monday and Tuesday, as the and this is true all week, as the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearings started, you had headlines in the New York Times that are things like, you know, Rumsfeld asks whether airstrikes will be sufficient in, against Baghdad, or U.S. invasion could have profound effect on economy. Well, you'd want to talk about a profound effect. How about a million dead in Iraq? That's profound. But you know,
and many dead U.S. soldiers as well.
Yeah.
But that's the nature of the discussion now. Is it's not within the U.S. public or the U.S. media. It's within the Bush administration.
Yes, that's where we're going next.
Yeah, we can take bets on it. You know, who do you think will win? Is it Colin Powell and the Pentagon who don't want a war in Iraq? That's a very strange alliance.
Well, Coleman,
in the first place,
Colin Powell, the Pentagon, and virtually every U.S. ally in Europe and around the world.
I'll get to that, but
they're all talking to Powell, and they're all very much hoping that Powell will
win. Powell is really the international representative to the Bush administration. But you have them on one side in an unusual alliance. Usually the State Department works against the Pentagon rather than with the Pentagon, versus Rumsfeld and Cheney, who want to go in and go after Saddam as soon as possible with as small a force as possible.
And Wolfowitz.
Of course, their underlings, Paul Wolfowitz, who is rabid. You can take bets as to who will win. Will it be Rumsfeld and Cheney and Wolfowitz versus, or will it be Colin Powell and the Pentagon? But that's the nature of the discussion right now. And what you have also is a situation where you have foreign leaders have gotten into the habit of lecturing George Bush. I mean, anytime he goes abroad, they lecture him. They try to explain what's going on in the world to a man who has a limited understanding.
Yeah, they think of it as tutoring, actually.
They do. But you're in a situation now where they're publicly lecturing George Bush and the Bush administration about the Middle East. And I have several, we don't have time, but I have several good quotes from the people in the Middle East who the U.S. would need in order to do this war. They would need to use bases in Turkey, in Jordan, in Saudi Arabia, and in Kuwait. All of the leaders of all of those countries.
All of the countries surrounding Iraq, basically.
Yeah, the leaders of all of those countries have said they don't want to go to war with Iraq. And in Jordan, in particular, will not allow the use of its bases. They have said that. We will not be used as a staging point. Turkey does not want to go to war because right now their government is unstable.
And they have an enormous Kurdish minority against Iraq would throw that entire situation into complete chaos.
Exactly, and the other governments involved have said, "Why do you want to throw gas on a fire instead of water? The Middle East is in flames right now. Let's talk about Israel and Palestine before we do anything with Iraq."
Yeah, it's and you know you also have to ask, where is the public pressure on this? Once again, I mean, it's like we could do a little segment on this program every week, what we should be bombarding our senators and representatives about this week. And you know, Iraq is an awfully good place to start, because this would be a disastrous action for the United States to take. And you know, I think it really is in the balance right now as to whether it will happen or not. We've been getting softened up, we being the public in this case, about how this will be inevitable, and you know, about having the debate about the logistics rather than about the why. You know, partially but, it's but, trial balloons. Partially
right.
It's to see how it will foot with the public, and it really is up in the balance, and, you know, some public pressure could make a difference
one. If you're going to call your senators about supporting Fast Track, tell them not to support war with Iraq.
Yeah, you know, if you sold us out on one, at least don't sell us out on the other. And even use the argument that it would have a profound effect on the economy, and you don't want to have to pay 3 cents a gallon more for your SUV.
Yeah, I would hope by now that our regular listeners have all their congressional and Senate representatives on speed dial.
On fast dial.
Yeah. And it's easy to find their numbers. They're listed in the phone book.
Yeah. And there is, the League of Women Voters puts out an excellent little pamphlet called They Represent You that is available free in a number of places around town that literally has phone numbers for all. I mean, you know, you can argue maybe with the title, but it has numbers of all the different legislatures, you know, all the way from the Capitol Hill all the way down to the school board. I mean, it really is a valuable little reference.
I was going to say the latest version actually put a question mark at the end of that. Do we only have a few minutes left, like 3 minutes. Is that enough time where you can give us an update on Quest, Maria?
Oh, let's see how quickly I can run through this. Quest had a lot of announcements that they made this week. First, on Monday, they announced that they would restate their earnings by $1 billion because of the swap contracts that they had entered into last year in 1999 through 2001. I could explain what those are, but
how many billion dollars are they going to shave off, you know, from week to week to week?
Well, $1 billion this week. Insiders say it could be another $500 million coming up soon. Mm-hmm. Tuesday, the New York Times reported that Quest executives had made at least $500 million selling company stock during 1999 to 2001, which was while they were cooking the books. And I'm just going to run through the list really quickly. Joseph Nocio, the CEO, made $227 million. Robert Woodruff, the ex-CFO, made $29 million, maybe more, selling his stock while they were cooking the books. Drake Tempest, the current general counsel, that's the company lawyer, he made $13 million. Philip Anschutz, this is the worst part, Philip Anschutz, a board member and the largest shareholder of Quest, made at least $1.5 billion on a single stock sale in May of 1999 while they were releasing untrue and inflated earnings figures for Quest.
If you saw, you know, the WorldCom executives being led away this week, remember these names because you're going to be seeing them led away
pretty
soon, too.
You should be seeing these Quest executives led away, too. Also, in the same report, they raised concerns about a big restatement of earnings could hurt Quest's attempts to sell its Dex directory service, which is supposed to help it get out of its $26 billion in debt.
Drop in the bucket.
I know. On Thursday, the Wall Street Journal reported that Quest's vendors are now demanding cash up front for services, and that could lead to a real cash flow crunch and an eventual bankruptcy filing.
Don't people have a bunch of debts coming due this coming month?
They do this month, and they have debts coming due early next year. But when their vendors demand cash up front, that's a problem because that's what led to the WorldCom filing bankruptcy, is that their vendors all wanted cash payment up front for services. So that's a real problem for Quest. Quest is headed in a downward spiral.
And what would that mean for local phone service?
Well, it will mean one of two things. It'll mean either Quest will have to sell to an outside company, which could lead to more problems as it did when US West sold to Quest, or Quest will have to lay off more workers, which means worse and worse and worse customer service at a company that's already notoriously bad for that.
My question is do you think the Quest Dex service lists the names of the people that you just whipped out there?
No.
Can we call them and ask where our $1.5 billion is? Very quickly, events this week.
Yeah, well, Jerry Paulette was on at 7:30, but for folks who didn't hear that or haven't heard our previous discussions of low-level nuclear waste at Hanford and at Yucca Mountain, the Department of Energy is having a hearing to talk about their low-level waste plans at Hanford, their usual tour around the Northwest and in Seattle. It will be this Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. There's a 6 o'clock public information sort of training that Heart of America and Physicians for Social Responsibility and others will be doing. That's at the Mountaineers Club, 300 3rd West in Seattle. Pinnacle Room.
And if you're planning to attend that, you might as well take Wednesday off, because Nick Licata is having a forum on replacing the viaduct at noon on Wednesday in the city council chambers. That's at 600 4th Avenue on the 11th floor. There will be speakers and a Q&A. They'll be reviewing whether or not there's money out there to replace the viaduct, and why are we opting for the most expensive plan.
Very good. So Wednesday's going to be a busy day.
Yep.
It will be.
All right, so talking once again with Maria Tomczyk and Jav Parrish, co-editors at Eat the State, and one of you tell us about where people can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, bars, restaurants all around town. We come out every other week in print form. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's eat the state, one word, .org. And if you want to contact us to volunteer or comment on anything you hear on this program or read in the paper, our phone number is 903-9461.
Area code 206.